So the next matter on our calendar is court file A190662, Pleasure Creek Townhomes versus American Family Insurance Company. Counsel, as you know, you each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And please identify yourselves for the record as you begin your arguments. I note there's two counsel for each side here. Is there going to be any time splitting here or not? How about for the respondents?
No, Your Honor.
Plaintiffs?
Not for the appellant, Your
Honor. All right. Then appellants may proceed. Right on the front there, you can adjust it up or down. There you go.
Good afternoon, or good morning, I suppose, and may it please the court. My name is Tim Johnson. I represent the appellant, Pleasure Creek Townhome Association. And if I could start by saying I'm a little bit under the weather, so if I enter into a coughing fit, please forgive me. I'd like to start today. This case at the district court was about whether or not a policy exclusion could operate to prohibit, or rather to preclude, American Family from paying for matching siding that was damaged in a hailstorm. The facts of this case are well briefed out. They are exactly and identical to the Cedar Bluff case that the Supreme Court heard just a few years ago.
Except Cedar Bluff didn't have a matching exclusion.
Correct. Yep, that is the one distinction in this case, is we're dealing with whether or not that matching exclusion essentially would change the outcome of the Cedar Bluff case. So at the district court, the court found that the matching exclusion was unambiguous and that it didn't violate 65A. Both of those are reversible errors, and I would remind the court, and I'm sure that you know, the court's role in these cases is to protect the policyholder. If the policy provision can be read in any way that is favorable to coverage, the court has to find in favor of coverage. So I'd like to start with simply the plain language of the matching endorsement. The matching endorsement or the matching exclusion says, we will not pay to repair undamaged material due to mismatch between undamaged material and new material used to repair and replace damaged material. That's a mouthful, but the way it ought to be read and the way that we argue that the district court should read it is that that applies when we're trying to match damaged material with undamaged material. It is undisputed in this case, and an appraisal panel submitted a binding award, that the damaged material at issue is siding. American Family wants...
Well, the damage... I understand your argument there, but I'm really struggling with that interpretation because the damaged material is the material that was damaged by the hail. The undamaged material is the siding that was not damaged by the hail. And the issue that you have here and why this provision seems to have been added in subsequent to the Cedar Bluff case is it talked about unmatched property damage. So in other words, it seems to explicitly apply this situation here. You've got siding that was damaged, some siding that wasn't. When you go to replace it, it's been sun aged, it's faded, and it's very, very difficult to match it. So basically the provision says, okay, we'll pay for the damage, but we're to the extent that it doesn't match the undamaged, we're not going to pay for the unmatched. So I really struggle with your interpretation that only siding, it covers all siding versus fascia or soffit or anything like that.
Sure, and I understand their argument too, and I'm not arguing that that isn't a possible way to interpret it. I'm arguing that it's possible to interpret it both ways.
Well, let me ask you that, because you start out saying the plain language, but I think, in fairness to you, I think your argument really is the policy is ambiguous because there's two or more reasonable interpretations.
Yeah, you're correct. I'm conflating my own arguments.
So, well, actually, let's take a step back.
But the reason I'm saying, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, in fairness to you, so your first argument is there is a plain meaning, and the plain meaning is the one that you're proposing.
Correct.
Your subsequent argument, alternative argument, is if it's determined to be ambiguous, here's one reasonable interpretation. Respondents have a second reasonable
yes,
interpretation.
That's exactly right. Okay. Thank you for the assist. That's what I meant. Okay. But as it applies to this exclusion, I think the most reasonable reading, and if we take our lawyer hats off for a second, understand that these are policyholders. The most reasonable reading of that exclusion is not that we won't restore your property that got damaged to the condition it was in before. In this case, all of the siding matched. It's that if it doesn't damage some other portion of the property, in this case, maybe an outbuilding, or we said soffits or fascias, then we don't pay for that. Now, that makes sense, and here's why. Because if we accept American Family's interpretation of that, then there is no minimum threshold coverage for the siding damage. For instance, if they don't have to pay to restore the property to what it used to look like kind and quality coverage is what we call that, and that was what the Cedar Bluff case latched onto, then they absolutely have no minimum standard for repair. So in their interpretation, they can literally tape duct tape or tarp over those damaged pieces of siding, and that's good enough. That is not a reasonable interpretation of this policy, and no policyholder would buy the policy if the policyholder thought that that was the coverage. And I want to point to just one thing in the Cedar Bluff case that's really important here. The question in the Cedar Bluff case is essentially what is damage? And the court said the policy doesn't define damage. This one doesn't either. It's the same policy. The court said that damage is any physical alteration or change to the property that is materially impaired after a hail loss. The mismatch itself, according to Justice Page, is damage. There is no way to exclude matching for the damaged material, which is siding. I would submit to you that there is a way to exclude for material that is completely undamaged. The shutters, the fascia, the gutters, that's what this exclusion applies to. It simply can't apply to the material that actually is damaged, or the resulting coverage is that the insurance company literally doesn't even have to repair it.
I'm still struggling. I understand your argument, but I'm still struggling with the plain language of this and seeing your interpretation as being reasonable, because it says, quote, "We will not pay to repair or replace undamaged material due to mismatch between undamaged material and new material used to prepare or replace damaged material." So it's talking about undamaged material due to mismatch between the undamaged material and the new material. It sounds like you're reading in a limitation that isn't there to differentiate damaged siding versus undamaged siding to mean siding, period, versus any other.
Sure, and to be fair, the exclusion says damaged material. It doesn't say pieces of, parts of, parcel of. It says damaged material. There is only one damaged material here, and that's siding. But I think
let me ask you this question.
Yes.
How is the siding that hasn't been affected by hail, how is that damaged material?
Good question. And the Cedar Bluff case answered that exactly, in that, and I think this goes a little bit to a reasonable expectations argument, that before the policy was struck by hail, it had uniform siding, right? And that was intentional. There's a reason people don't have patchwork quilts on the side of their homes. That was intentional. The mismatch itself is a part of the physical loss because the property has been damaged and that it doesn't look like it used to look. It's pretty easy to understand that the property would be devalued in a situation where there were piecemeal repairs, for instance, in the duct tape and tarp argument that I referred to earlier. I think that your point is well taken, though, because it illustrates that there are absolutely more than one way to read this policy exclusion. And to get where they get, you have to read in that they want this material exclusion to refer to pieces of material that were physically struck by hail and not the ones that weren't. I think if they would have written it that way, then that would be a legitimate exclusion. But what we're looking at today is not the policy American Family wished that it wrote. It's the policy that it actually did write. And the policy that it actually did write does not exclude this particular covered loss, which is to restore the property to the way it used to look before it got damaged, a fundamental replacement cost coverage provision.
Well, it sounds like you're, again, reading in language to replace it to make it look the way it did originally, and that's not what this, that language isn't in here at all. It just talks about replacing damaged material and not replacing undamaged material due to mismatch.
Sure, and you have to take one step back in the policy to get there, and that's to look at what the policy defines as damage. It doesn't. If the policy did, I don't think we would be here. And the Supreme Court has already done that analysis for you. The damage is any physical alteration of the property. And as I said, Justice Page found that the mismatch constitutes an alteration of the property, which is a covered loss under this exact policy. I want to move on, though, to another part of this argument that's really important. And this is an area where this court can provide some serious clarification in the law. And that's whether or not 65A, Minnesota Standard Fire Policy, applies when there's a non-fire loss. The language of the statute, or the its purpose and scope, is really important. The language of the statute says, no policy or contract of fire insurance shall be made unless it shall provide the coverages specified herein. And coverage, and with respect to the coverage against the peril of fire, the policy or contract shall afford all of the rights and benefits of the Minnesota Standard Fire Policy. The argument between the parties is this. Our argument is that that statute means that if the policy provides coverage for fire, then it has to conform with the minimum requirements of 65A. American Family's argument is, well, that only applies if there's actually been a fire loss. But this statute is clearly not backward-looking in that way. The statute is referring to the coverages under the policy. And this is important because the coverage under the policy, if we stood in a vacuum and there had been no loss, we would be able to walk into court and ask for a declaratory judgment that says this policy does not comply with the minimum requirements of 65A. Court, you have to reform that and put in the like, kind, and quality coverage that was removed by American Family because it's in violation of the Standard Fire Policy. The Standard Fire Policy has a remedial purpose. It's to prevent insureds from being deprived of minimum coverages that they expect. In this case, the question is not whether a fire loss occurred. It's a question of whether this policy covers fire. And this is a really easy thing for an insurance company to fix. Most policies in the state of Minnesota have separate coverages for fire, which complies with the Standard Fire Policy, and separate coverages for wind and hail. This one doesn't. It's an all-perils policy. So it has the same coverage with respect to fire, with respect to lightning, with respect to tornadoes. And for that reason, there is no discernible difference between the fire coverage and the hail coverage at issue here.
It does seem like it is, because you've got the general talking about coverage against fire, perils of fire, and coverage against other perils. But then the next sentence is the more specific that says such policy or contract with respect to the peril of fire. So it's limiting the general statement before. And generally you have general statement more specific and the specific controls. And so it seems pretty clear that when it's talking about with respect to the peril of fire, that it's limited to
peril. I completely agree. And with respect to the peril of fire, this policy does not provide that coverage. That makes that provision void as a matter of law because it violates the Standard Fire Policy. The way to get around that is to separate the coverages for the different perils. If they had a fire policy and a hail policy, or a hail rider, which is actually more common, then they would not be in direct contradiction of the statute. So with respect to the peril of fire, this policy does not conform. And the reason this is important is because there is disparate case law everywhere. The Eighth Circuit just found, based on a footnote in an old Supreme Court case in 1986, that this only applies when a fire loss occurs. But that's contradictory to a case in 2000, the Nath Brothers case, which we cite in our reply, where the Supreme Court applied the Standard Fire Policy to an ice and water loss. The Standard Fire Policy applies if the policy covers the peril of fire, period, full stop. If the coverages are divided out, as they are in most policies in Minnesota, then that argument is different. Then this exclusion would not violate 65A because it wouldn't deprive a fundamental coverage under 65A. With the last bit of remaining time I have, I want to get to some of the other ambiguities in the policy. And I won't get into all of them, there's two provisions that are in conflict that render this matching exclusion void. The first is the matching exclusion is added to the property loss condition section of the policy. It doesn't belong there. It's an exclusion, but that's beside the point. The endorsements and exclusions, there's about 160 pages in this policy. If you go through the remainder of the policy, you'll find that a separate provision adds another paragraph 9 to property loss condition section. That means that the policyholder has to figure out which of these paragraph 9s apply and which of them don't. They're conflicting. And now I know American Family's argument is, just add a paragraph 10. The court can't do that. You absolutely cannot. It is unfair to the policyholder, and it's contrary to the fundamental principles of policy interpretation to find in favor of coverage whenever possible and to construe that ambiguity against the drafter. The court may not rewrite American Family's policy. I would urge the court to remember that's a multi-billion-dollar corporation. They have far more expensive lawyers than all of us sitting here that are capable of drafting a clear policy. When they don't, the court has to find in favor of the policyholder. In addition to this conflicting Section 9s, there's three separate coverages. There's the primary coverage under the policy. Both of us agree that the primary coverage under the policy is the same as Cedar Bluff. Like kind and quality, it provides matching. According to American Family, there's a matching exclusion, which moves it away. The parties in this case, though, also have a separate purchased condominium enhancement endorsement. And I won't bore you with going through all of the details, but in relevant part, that enhancement, that additional coverage, provides like kind and quality coverage. There's only one way to read those provisions in harmony. If you accept American Family's position that the matching exclusion applies exactly as they say it does, and that's the primary coverage gives matching, the exclusion takes it away, and the enhanced endorsement for the condominium endorsement gives it back. I would remind the court that we're here today to talk about the policy that American Family wrote, not the policy they wish they wrote. The court is not allowed to reform the policy to give the benefit of the doubt to American Family. They've got enough money, they've got enough expertise. If this is what they wanted the policy to say, they could have wrote it that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Dan Millay on behalf of respondent. I think this appeal turns on three essential issues, and that's what I'm going to try to focus on, subject, of course, to the court's questions. First, the non-matching exclusion is unambiguous. Second, the structure of the American Family policy is clear. And third, the standard fire policy provisions do not apply to this loss as a non-fire loss. With those three propositions established, I think it's clear that the district court's decision should be affirmed. First, absence of ambiguity. I think it's clear what happened here, and Judge Reyes alluded to it with his questioning. Cedar Bluff decision came down. American Family was a party to that case. And that decision required that under the terms of that policy, which had no matching exclusion, American Family would have to replace undamaged material siding to match the new material because of a fading issue, slight mismatch issue. And I want to just note for the court, the mismatching issue is not black versus red. It's not green versus blue. It tends to be a slight mismatch. And you can see in the photograph attached to respondent's addendum at 9, that's a photograph from the appraisal process where the appraisers are taking a sample and putting it next to the existing siding to see how close of a match do we have. That's the kind of matching issue that they come to. And they try to determine, is this reasonable or is it not close enough and do we have a matching problem? In the photograph, you really can't see whether it matches or mismatches, but it shows you that's how close they're dealing with the extent of fading and the ability to match the color. The other thing I would ask you to
keep... Is matching related just to fading, though? I mean, this is vinyl siding. I mean, it could have any sort of pattern that wouldn't match also, but might stand out as, even though it's the same color. I mean, does it apply to those types of circumstances, too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Color is an example, but there are other issues that can arise, as you noted. And typically the situation is on the ground, and this is what happened in this appraisal. There's damage on, say, the west-facing elevation, or maybe there's damage on two elevations. But rarely do you find hail damage all around the building. If there is damage on one elevation, all that siding is going to be replaced, typically, and that was the case here. What's at issue is on the undamaged sides of the buildings, does that have to be replaced so that each side is a perfect match? And that's what this exclusion was designed to address, because under Cedar Bluff, without a matching exclusion, and with a policy form very similar to the form here, American Family would be required to do that. So what did they do? they drafted a matching exclusion to address that very point.
So I think you're telling us no one would reasonably take out a section, even on one wall, and replace it with, you know, if that pattern and color had been discontinued, that they wouldn't replace it, you know, with a plaid, you know, different color. But what tells us that that's the case? And you're saying, well, they'll typically do the full site. But, I mean, if we just look at this language, what would stop the insurer from just, as opposing counsel said, just putting in, if it's discontinued or whatever, just putting in that portion and having, you know, like a section that looks terrible?
That's a very fair point, Your Honor. Here's the larger issue, and I'll come to your point. American Family certainly could have said to Justice Page during the Cedar Bluff briefing and argument, this is unfair to require us to match, because what if one panel on a large building had one chip that was identified as a marking from a hailstone? Do we have to really replace the entire siding on the entire building to address that one small chip? I think Justice Page would say, yes, you do. You haven't said that you don't have to do that, and we believe comparable material and quality means you've got to replace the building, and that means you've got to match. You've got to have a color match and otherwise match the material. Now, that's an extreme example that wouldn't be very fair to American Family, but it would be the truth under Cedar Bluff. With this exclusion, I will acknowledge, Your Honor, that you could have another extreme example where there is damage to 10 panels out of 20 on the west elevation. And the insurance company could point to the matching exclusion and say, we're going to replace those 10, but the other 10 of the 20 are not damaged. We're not going to replace that. In reality, that doesn't happen. You wouldn't really save any cost, but it could. Under this exclusion, it could. But it's not practical to draft around every possible potential issue that could arise in the field. American Family hasn't done that, and frankly, I don't think any insurer can do that, but they certainly do apply rules of reason in the field to try to be reasonable, to try to be fair, and to do a reasonable match as best they can. What they don't want to do is to replace every elevation of 14 buildings or 20 buildings when there is only damage on, say, the west elevation. They want it just to address what's been damaged and give a reasonable color match, which normally can be done. I want to address one other issue from the Cedar Bluffs case, which I think is important. The court began that opinion by noting what exactly it was reviewing, what exactly it had accepted for review. And the court said, quote, we granted review to determine if the appraisal panel properly concluded that American Family's obligation to replace damaged property with property of comparable material and quality required it to replace damaged and undamaged property to achieve a color match. Justice Page never said that siding that has faded or is otherwise not a match with new siding is somehow damaged. What he said later in the opinion is the building has been damaged by hail, and to address the overall damage to the building, since you haven't otherwise said what comparable material and quality means in this context, we, the Supreme Court, believe you've got an obligation to do a match and to replace that undamaged material, that siding, to match the new siding. So I would take issue with counsel's suggestion that the opinion says faded siding is damaged. The building is what's damaged.
Counsel, can you address the last issue that appellant raised in terms of the order of the endorsements and why their reading isn't an appropriate one of basically, you've got the overall policy, you've got the matching exclusion, but then you basically replace that with the final provision saying, you know, putting it back in, essentially.
Yes, thank you, Judge Reyes, for the question. That's exactly what I wanted to address next. We have a base policy form known as the business owner's coverage form, similar to the form that was at issue in Cedar Bluff, and that includes a section 1, subparagraph E5D1A. Right, that's a lot of alphabet soup, but the real key provision there is the 1A at the end of it. That subparagraph in the original base policy explains the replacement cost valuation methodology. And what it says is we'll pay to replace with comparable material and quality with some limitations. You can't exceed the policy limit. There could be a co-insurance penalty. And specifically, that cost is capped at the cost to replace damaged property with comparable material and quality. Then we have the condominium enhancement endorsement that council referred to. What does that do? Well, it says, quote, at the start, this endorsement modifies insurance provided under the business owner's coverage form. It doesn't replace the business owner's coverage form. It modifies it in various ways, including that subparagraph 1A that I referenced. With respect to that subparagraph, it replaces the entire subparagraph. But all it really does, if you compare them side by side, it takes out the policy limit reference, and it takes out the potential coinsurance penalty. But it leaves in verbatim the language about comparable material and quality, and that the cost of that repair caps the recovery. So that the idea that the order in which you read these provisions impacts the outcome is a false premise, because the endorsement, the condominium endorsement, leaves Section 1A in place to the extent it has any application to this case and to the claim at issue here. We then have the unmatched property damage exclusion endorsement, which I won't read back into the record. I think you probably heard it enough today, but it is clear, it is plain. It doesn't say anything about comparable material and quality. It doesn't address Section 1A. It simply says, all else being equal, we will not pay to repair that undamaged property. It's very clear. So the comparable material and quality language was in the policy originally. It's always in the policy. It was never taken out because the endorsement, the condo endorsement, didn't address that portion of 1A. It only removed the other provisions of 1A. As for the duplicate loss condition E9, so the matching endorsement is E9, and then we've got a Minnesota Changes townhomes endorsement that also adds a different E9 that relates to other insurance issues. That was a mistake. Somebody should have realized we've got two E9s, so one of these endorsements should be modified to make sure we have an E9 and an E10. I acknowledge that. But the two provisions, both lettered numbered E9, speak to completely different issues. So I would submit that an insured couldn't look at those two provisions and say, I don't know which one of these applies. Does one cancel out the other? Well, it couldn't. If they had been appropriately numbered, E9 and E10, but they were in conflict. So one said you've got matching coverage and the other said you don't have matching coverage. I would say, well, even though they were numbered correctly, it's still ambiguous which of these controls, because they seem to be in direct conflict. The fact that they're numbered correctly or incorrectly is substantively irrelevant. What is relevant is they don't conflict, they address different issues, and what we have is a policy with a Scrivener's error that has two paragraph E9s.
Well, not only do you have that, but you also have, it seems like it's an odd place to put the matching exclusion. When you look at those two, isn't that creating ambiguity in the contract? And ambiguities are held against the scrivener.
Yeah, I understand that concern, Your Honor, but I would point out that the endorsement has, in all capital letters at the top of the endorsement, and it's a single-page standalone document, quote, this endorsement changes the policy. Please read it carefully. And it's also titled as an exclusion endorsement. And a policyholder reading that would realize, I don't have matching coverage, because it's very explicit. It could have been placed in another section, certainly could have, but it really does go to the loss conditions, because it goes to a modification of how you determine what the insurer is required to pay for when it's adjusting a loss. So it's also appropriate to put it in the loss conditions. The last thing I wanted to touch on, Your Honors, my remaining time, is the standard fire insurance policy requirements and the case law that speaks to those requirements. As Judge Reyes pointed out, 65A01 specifically refers to those requirements being required only with respect to the peril of fire. And this question of, well, does that mean that a policy that is an all-risk policy has to have all those provisions? Or does it mean an all-risk policy needn't have those conditions unless it's being applied to an actual fire loss? That's been answered by the Henning decision, which both parties discussed in their briefs. The Henning court quoted 65A01 and then said, we hold This isn't dicta. They said, we hold, therefore, that the provisions of the standard fire policy apply only to fire losses, not to non-fire losses, under an all-risk insurance policy. It's directly on point to the issue before this court. That language did appear in a footnote, but it was essential to the outcome of the case because there were three potential limitations that could have applied. The one-year limitation, suit limitation provision in the policy at issue, the two-year limitation in the standard fire policy, or the general six-year limitation for contract actions in Minnesota. And the court found the six-year limitation applies and said to the insurer, your one-year limitation is unreasonably short, and therefore it can't apply. So the six-year limitation applies. What the footnote says is the insurer had an alternative argument, which was, okay, if our one-year provision is too short, then you should apply the standard fire policy two-year provision. And that's why the court, in that footnote, analyzed 65A01 and said it doesn't apply here because this is a non-fire loss. It was essential to the outcome. It's not dicta, and it's still good law. The Noonan Court, the Eighth Circuit Court, that issued a decision on a similar matching exclusion earlier this year, also addressed 65A01, cited the Henning decision, and agreed with Henning that 65A01 didn't apply to that non-fire loss. Lastly, counsel noted the Nath Brothers case. They mentioned that in their reply brief, and he mentioned it today during argument. I think it's important to read Nath to understand what proposition it actually stands for. That court did discuss the standard fire policy provisions, and it discussed the policy that was before it, and it was a non-fire loss. That is true. But the court never went into analysis of does the policy apply or does the standard fire policy provisions apply. In fact, it noted that the insurer counsel at argument agreed that the provision at issue was essentially the same under either policy, and the provision was a timely proof of loss provision. And the court found that under either of those policies, a timely proof of loss provision was not a condition precedent to recovery. That's what the case was about. Because the policies were not in conflict, there was no need for the court to dig any further into 65A01 and whether that was the applicable policy or the insurer's policy was applicable. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Johnson, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
I would just like to quickly address the argument we were just talking about, the standard fire policy. I think the arguments here today illustrate that there is some ambiguity in that statute. Does it apply post-fire, or does it apply anytime the policy covers fire? The question for this court is, if you can read that statute both ways, what do we think the legislative intent of that statute was? Well, I'll tell you this. The intent of that statute is remedial. It is intended to protect policyholders. So if you can go either way on that statute, you should presume that the legislature didn't think that a fire loss was somehow different than a hail loss, and that for a fire loss, they should have to replace with like kind and quality material. But if it's any other kind of loss, we should reach a different result. There's absolutely no way the legislature intended that. If you have a question before you where you can go both ways on that, and clearly you can, the arguments are well supported on both sides of this particular issue.
Pardon me. Why doesn't Henning decide this case?
Henning doesn't decide this case because that issue wasn't actually central to the case. It was a throwaway footnote addressing an alternative argument that the court didn't need to reach because it had already issued its order in the prime part of the opinion.
As I understand the argument that it was critical to determine which statute of limitations applied. Is that right?
Yeah, the question in the prime part of the case was whether or not the reduction in limitation period was reasonable. Mm-hmm. And that question is answered under 54105, Minnesota's statute of limitations statute. The entire case was about that. The court issued a footnote about the alternative argument in what I would call a throwaway fashion. I don't disagree with you. The court held that in its dicta in that footnote. But the Nath Brothers case.
But why is it dicta if it rejected the 2 year in favor of six?
Because the court didn't need to reach that argument. It was superfluous. The court said in its dicta that it didn't need to reach that because it was an alternative argument. But it answered it anyway. Okay. But it wasn't central to the outcome of the case. It could have been had the court's prime decision not been couched in whether or not that was reasonable. I understand we're mincing words a little bit here, but this is an important issue that I don't think the court has really ever addressed.
Well, but the court did say, and did court, the Supreme Court did use the language "we hold," which is very, very specific language that the Minnesota Supreme Court uses, and it was an alternative argument that was raised that the Minnesota Supreme Court did address, albeit in footnote number 8, but it still addressed that issue.
But I can't disagree with you.
But even if you look at the Noonan case, the 2019 case from the Eighth Circuit, they specifically pointed to that and said the Minnesota Supreme Court has already held and interpreted that language. So it doesn't seem like that language is, there's any ambiguity based on not only the Minnesota Supreme Court's interpretation, but the Eighth Circuit's interpretation of looking at that case as well.
Hennon case. Yeah, and here's the problem, Judge Rage, and if I'm taking off the advocate hat and asking what we should do as lawyers here for a second. The challenge with the Henning Nelson case is that wasn't essential to the decision. The challenge with the Noonan case is it also didn't question whether or not the statute says what we're saying it says because it relied on that case. I don't believe that the court spent any time analyzing that statute, and I don't think that that was central to the outcome. So the question is can you read that statute both ways? If we were to, precedent.
Right, we can't disregard precedent, but also, I think that the Noonan court looked at that decision and said, that's not an issue anymore. The Supreme Court has clarified the meaning of that statute. So I think we'd be hard-pressed as an error-correcting court to go contrary to those two decisions right there.
If it has, though, the subsequent case, the Nath Brothers case, which actually was fundamental to the decision, the application of the standard fire policy, would be in conflict. We've got disparate decisions, and for that reason, the court has an opportunity to clarify.
That's in conflict because the Nath decision was a 2000 Minnesota Supreme Court case.
Correct.
And Noonan was a 2019, just this year, Eighth Circuit Supreme Court case, looking back at those decisions.
Yes, Your Honor, but I personally know, that argument was never raised in that court, and what the Eighth Circuit decides is not binding on a Minnesota court. I would submit that you are in a far better position to decide the application of Minnesota 65A than the Noonan court. I'm not saying that they're bad judges, but even good judges get it wrong sometimes. So I want to end with this fundamental principle is what American Family is asking you to do is to rewrite the policy in the way that they wish they would have written it originally. The court cannot entertain that argument. It has to apply the policy as written. And if American Family had simply said to the policyholder, sent them something in writing, hey, this is what this provision means. Here's our color-coded diagram and 5 pages of legal argument about why we think you should apply the policy in this way. If the policyholders actually knew, if they had any way to figure that out on their own, nobody would buy this policy. That's the dirty little secret. You want to know why it's confusing and we're here? Because nobody would buy the policy if it was clear. And for that reason, the court needs to apply the language as it's written and not as American Family wishes it would have. And with that, unless you have any questions, I see my time is up.
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you so much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We have your briefs. The matter with the issues were certainly clearly briefed, and your positions are well outlined. Your arguments highlighted that. We appreciate your assistance here today. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we'll have a decision on the matter within 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you.